created to fear, how fear transforms our likeness. I think you would agree that we could say that everyone experiences some element of fear. In fact, if we were to look at the way the secular world understands this idea of fear, fear certainly belongs in the category of something that is bad, something that's not healthy, something that's not good. We have all sorts of categories, ways in which we attempt to categorize different elements of fear. We have what are called modern psychopathologies. These are ways in which we categorize these issues of fear, right? We have the category in the DSM, for example, called the generalized anxiety disorder, where there's a list of criteria and explanations of certain symptoms that a person may exhibit or experiences that they have. And so if you have a certain amount of those over a certain amount of time, you can be categorized as having a certain psychopathology known as generalized anxiety disorder, one of the most diagnosed disorders in the DSM. A similar diagnosis, panic disorder. The criteria is slightly different, maybe slightly more intense because of the outward behavioral expression of that. But we have different ways that we're trying to explain these types of experiences that we have in life. One of the things that I want you to pay attention to is it's not that the world can't see what we experience as human beings, but we have to make a really important distinction here. Being people who are made in the image of God, we are interpreters by nature. Being made in the image of God intended to be what Paul Tripp called revelation receivers, meaning that as we're receiving revelation from nature, as we're observing what's going on, we need to make meaning and purpose behind what it is that we see. We need to give value to something that we see. We have to help make it fit into some sort of system in the pattern of how we understand things. We're trying to make meaning and we're trying to make understanding. And this is why, biblically speaking, it is such an indictment the way the Bible describes those who are unbelievers, that they have eyes but cannot see, right? There's something missing in the way in which they see. One of the things that I like to do when I'm talking to my students there at Midwestern Baptist Seminary, I always have international students. And one of the things that I love to do is to request that one of my international students join me up at the front. And on the whiteboard, I have them write a phrase in whatever language it is that's their native language. And it's always very interesting, because as they write the language up there, one of the most recent ones I had do something like this was from India. And so as she stands up there writing, what's interesting is you can see information that's on the board. You can tell it seems to have been placed there by someone who has intelligence, but nobody in the room knows what in the world it means. But it's really interesting because as they're looking at the letters, as it were, in that language, they're trying to make sense of it. And so they start guessing all the, you know, main Jesus verses, right? Thinking that they might know what it is that the student writes up there or whatever. But they're trying to make sense of it. They're trying to make meaning of it. It's the same thing that you and I do when we're seeing life unfold. We're trying to make sense of it. And depending upon the backdrop or the lens by which you see through, it dictates how you see a thing. When we look at, for example, like generalized anxiety disorder or panic disorder or agoraphobia, some of you, if you struggle with this particular disorder, you might struggle this week because that's a fear of crowds or being around crowds. Separation anxiety disorder, we hear a lot about that in discussions relative to foster care or adoption or something like that. My point is simply this: it's we're labeling something, we're putting meaning and purpose with a certain language, right? It's a certain way of describing and interpreting bits of information. And I think we have to be careful at the ways in which we interpret that information, because anytime you have a label associated with something, particularly in our world, it has baggage that comes with it. Now, it's not to say that observations of what is given is necessarily wrong. But when you start placing labels like this on someone, it is giving a sense of meaning, purpose, and value behind the experiences that a person has. So I think we have to be cautious and careful. Not only do we have particular psychopathologies, we also have different words that we describe these types of phobias. And my point in bringing these up is just simply to say, when we talk about fear, our world is not unaware of the issue of fear. It's something that we struggle with to a great degree. Aerophobia, can you imagine what that is? What is that? No, it's a fear of drafts of air, gases, or airborne matter. A few years ago, all of us were aerophobia to some degree. Papyrophobia, can you guess what that is? You've been cut by papers one too many times. And it's interesting, the definition actually goes so far as to say it's persistent fear of papers, plain or crumpled. Yeah, I'm not afraid of flat paper, but if it's crumpled, like, look out. Okay. Acrophobia is a fear of heights. Yeah. Nyctophobia, a fear of darkness or a fear of the night. Some of your kids share that particular fear. You see, what happens is we have a tendency to lump together and to label things in a particular way. And the problem with some of these things is as we label fear a certain way, it limits how we think about fear. It limits where we think fear comes from, and it limits what we think is the underlying problem related to the issue of fear. In our current world, we have a tendency, sort of two philosophies in the secular world, and we've seen if you were to study a history of psychiatry or a history of psychology, you would see an ebb and flow of its history in what's called romantic psychiatry or biological psychiatry. And simply what that means is romantic psychiatry is more like psychology. It's driven by a romanticized idea from the Enlightenment, a romanticized idea of people. Much more poetic, much more artistic, much more creative. It's where talk therapy comes from, for example. It's where in French history, moral therapy came from. And moral therapy was not anything religious particularly, just had an element of a creative, animated aspect of who humanity really is. Biological psychiatry is the explanation that we are who we are and we do the things that we do because of the biology that we have or the genetic structure that we have. And everything is reduced down to that element of who we are. And what's interesting to me is we know biblically we are made body and soul. And so we can't understand people outside of this dualistic understanding of man, that man is both, yes, body and soul. And we recognize that as we understand secular psychology, because what ultimately happens, and I would say we have a tendency to do this in the church in the same way that the secular culture does this as well, is we have a tendency to want to reach for the closest common denominator to use explanatory power over something. Okay, now let me explain what I mean. What we want to do is we want to find the lowest common denominator to give us terms to explain what's wrong with us or what's happening to us. And so we have a tendency, either if we operate according to a more naturalistic philosophy like we do today, much more driven by science and naturalism and so on, then we have a tendency to explain things in a biological sense, right? That the reason that you drink is because you are an alcoholic. And how do we understand that term? Which thankfully that's changing. But how do we understand that term? Typically, well, it's because of some sort of genetic predisposition that you have or whatever. We're trying to attempt to explain and give a label to something to reduce it down to its lowest common denominator. I call that, or what's called in the secular world, biological reductionism, where we're reducing down what we see into one primary explanation because we feel like it gives us explanatory power over a particular thing. Does that make sense? So when we deal with issues like anxiety or fear, to offer some sort of label, we may explain it in a lot of different ways. We may use a term like generalized anxiety disorder. And depending upon which philosophy you hold, because again, going back to the DSM never says they know the etiology of a thing. but it's intended to help inform a